I have to wait for my senior god sister to stop talking. All right. Now, we're continuing with our urban preaching seminar. Now, yesterday, you remember, we passed out this newspaper article about the million Bhakta army of devotees and what they discovered after spending millions of dollars of research. They found out that they were missing the point because people had changed. And this also is affecting our Krishna conscious preaching. Very much today, those under 40 are very anti-institutional, anti-organizational. During Prabhupada's time of physical presence, people were very willing to be a part of some organization as long as the goals of the organization were good. Now there is a great cynicism about spiritual organizations, and as Mother Lakshmi was pointing out, the New Age movement has its effect in that everyone thinks spirituality is your own personal affair. It can't be organized. It can't be managed. It's just do your own thing and do it by yourself and keep it to yourself. So basically what we're dealing with is the same thing that the U.S. Army discovered, that today's younger generation, meaning under 30 certainly, they're much more individualistic and independent than ever before, and they have a widespread perception that belonging to some kind of organization, whether it's the army or ISKCON, makes you into a faceless, nameless cog in an impersonal machine. And why would being part of an organization, how could that be positive for your spiritual life when spiritual life is your own personal affair? So this is what we're running up against. Now, we also discussed how the U.S. Army counteracted that perception with their Army of One presentation. You remember what it was like, one lone soldier running across the desert with his pack on his back and his gun. And then going the opposite way, there's a squadron of soldiers running the opposite way. And then overhead, military helicopters flying. But this lone soldier keeps going on in his own direction. Not paying attention to the big squad of soldiers that went the opposite way and the helicopter roaring over his head. And then he says, even though there are over 1 million soldiers just like me, I am my own force. With technology, with training, with support, who I am has become better than who I was. And I'll be the first to tell you, the might of the U.S. Army doesn't lie in numbers. It lies in me. I am an army of one. So, and we talked about how there was some argument amongst army leaders that are we tossing out our internal values, which have been with us for centuries, of selflessness, sacrifice for the nation, for the country, cohesion. And the conclusion was no. As the former head of the army said, it's not that as an institution we're advocating self-centered behavior, but the fact is you've got to get them into the door to try out our selfless service that we're offering. You got to get them into the door. In other words, they have to get a taste first. Otherwise, the way people are these days, you just can't say, come on, sign up and lose yourself into the impersonal machine. They're not ready for that. Whether people are capable of managing their own life, that's another question. But the fact is, it's part of the social image these days to think that you can deal with yourself and you've got your lifestyle It's become a very hallowed, sacred thing, your lifestyle. So this is how people are looking at Krishna consciousness. What's it going to do for my lifestyle? What's it going to do for me? What transformations is it going to produce in me? What do you have to offer to me? It's not that I just want to belong to an organization. It's not that I want to merge with some bhaktas or bhaktins. What do you guys offer for me and my lifestyle? That's the way it is these days. So, now here you are in the city. That's going to be our theme today. Cities, why and what to do. My opinion is that there's no way anyone can be an effective preacher in a city who has attachment for a city. Who thinks that cities are, they're okay places. They have their bad points, but things are convenient. It's kind of nice, all the action. If you have any of those kind of sentiments, it's going to prevent you from seeing the horrible destruction that is going on in cities these days, where young men and women are being slaughtered from basically the age of 12 in the most gross and abominable ways. So we discussed on the first day that the refugees from this slaughter are becoming your candidates in Krishna consciousness. So the first thing necessary is to understand how cities are indeed hellish places. And why would a devotee want to be in a city except to preach? There's no other reason. Other than preaching, we've got better things to do than live in a city. So therefore, if a devotee is in the city, he should understand, assuming it's not just because of economic reasons, he or she has to support the family or what, you know, complications like that. But other than that, the only reason that a devotee should be in a city is to preach, to show compassion on the people of the city. Otherwise, for us as devotees, it's a horrible place. Kali Yuga saturation at every moment. But if we're going to be there, and we do have urban centers for the most part, in ISKCON we have urban centers. Since we are in the city, why don't we figure out how to cope with cities? What's happened, though, as I said on the first day, is in many ISKCON cities of the world, we've put on blinders. And yes, we're in the city, and here is our city center. But in very few places I've seen, and I go all around the world, very few places devotees are actually trying to cope with what it means to have a Krishna conscious center in today's cities. What's happening in today's cities? Far more stress than 10 years ago. And don't be fooled. Don't think that because of all the illicit sex and casual association between sexes, amongst the same sex, don't think that people are full of friends. No. The shocking truth you'll find out if you take the time to talk to people in cities is that they are more lonely than ever before. But they'll never admit that at first. Everyone will admit that they're stressed out. In Melbourne, Australia, a couple of months ago, Melbourne is it's a city of about 3 million. I was doing university programs there. Usually in Australia, you do a university program and you get about 20 people, of which 15 are Indian students from abroad. But this time we tried a different approach. We passed out flyers saying we're going to have a lecture on stress and city lifestyles. So, you know, I walked in for the program expecting, okay, here we go again, usual university program, 20 persons, out of which 15 are Indian, and, It'll be great if that's what it is. I walked in, and there were 300 students waiting. 300 students. And they were 85% of them were Australian, not Indian. I was just shocked. Because they're all so stressed out. That's the thing everyone will immediately admit. I've got so much stress, so much anxiety, because the job market is so fierce these days. The competition for getting a good job is so anxiety-filled. And so therefore, everyone readily admits, I'm so stressed out. So that was one day, 300 students. The next day, we did the same program again at a nearby university, 400 students. So I could see this is what's happening. People are driven by stress to the point of despair. They don't know what to do. They're willing to hear from anyone. Let's go hear from a Hare Krishna. I got to understand how to handle this stress. But there's one thing, as I said, they will not admit to, which is even more a powerful motivating factor. And that's, you got to be very clever to pick that up, because they're not going to immediately tell you. They are so lonely. And it's hard for you to understand it, because you think, everyone's got girlfriends, boyfriends, this, that, coming out of their ears and their nose. How can they be lonely? But this is how Maya works. They're so full of random encounters and connections, yet they're so lonely. So you can use this for administering Lord Chaitanya's medicine. A devotee knows, a preacher knows they're lonely, but we don't rub that in their face. Not that as soon as they walk in your door, hi, Hari Bol, I know you're lonely. No, it's not like that. You just act on that knowledge, and you will see the result. You'll see. But so many devotees I've talked to, they've kind of psyched out. They're kind of like, they're out of touch with these dynamics because they just assume, come on, they must, they've had, 50 boyfriends in 1 year, 50 girlfriends. Things are so, everything is so social these days. There's no privacy. Everyone gives himself, herself to this one, that one. No, they're amazingly lonely. And if you talk to them, you'll find out that's what's going on. They're doing all these things externally, but their heart is not satisfied, and they feel more lonely than ever before. Generally, you think of a lonely person, according to conceptions of 30 or 40 years ago. A 16-year-old girl with no girlfriends, no boyfriends, just sitting inside her house, looking out the window, wondering, does anyone care about me? Who can I talk to? Or maybe some kind of computer nerd type of boy, who knows all about computers but can't make friends with people. No, the loneliness is much different these days. And if you talk to people, you'll find this out, that although they've had 20 boyfriends, girlfriends in 6 months, still they feel completely devoid of meaningful relationships. So we can use that basic need to our advantage. We can offer companionship without letting them know we understand what's going on. How do you find out these things? You have to be able to talk to people and find out where they're at. But as I pointed out on the first day, most, 95% of our urban centers have no place where you can comfortably sit down and talk to guests. 95% of them don't have that. Fortunately, we only have one or two persons here from the UK, so, and I know these tapes will not go across the channel. So just take not to single one place out, but take, for example, Soho Street. You are in the middle of the most bustling part of London, and all kinds of people are always moving through that area. But in our Soho Temple, there is not one place where you can sit down and talk to someone. You have to do it in the hallway. The temple room is there with the marble floor. But there's not one place you can go and sit down in the middle of this stressful city millions of people circulating. There's not one place where you can sit down and talk to a guest and inquire about their life. Not one place. You have to do it while standing in the hallway. And that is normal. I'm not singling out one place and saying, you know, no, I'm just using it as a glaring example. We just assume in so many of our cities that, well, the deities are there, the marble floor is there, the Vyasasana is there. Okay, we're preaching. We've made a facility, a suitable facility for everyone to hear about Krishna consciousness. No, you're not going to get your average Western person to relax and strike up a relationship with you without certain props, without certain scenery. So what you want to do, so they'll open up to you, what you want to do is create your own scene in which it has the ambience, and I've been told that's a French word, so I don't know, it has the ambience in which people will relax and start relating to you. So therefore, think about what do Westerners do when they want to be cool and relax. More than staying at home, they go to clubs, they go to cafes. And the whole purpose of the atmosphere in the clubs and the cafes is that people start opening up. They start relaxing. Why can't we provide them that kind of place in Krishna consciousness? Well, they'll open up and relax in a way that we can distribute Krishna consciousness to them gradually. The very evils of the city, nightclubs, cafes, we can use for Lord Chaitanya's purpose by making like a Krishna conscious lounge or club in which people come and they feel, this is a place I can go to and just unwind. The people are for real. No one's pushing on your case heavily. No one's like a heavy missionary. The food is great. The atmosphere is great. Yeah, I can come and unwind here. Practically every day. That's the kind of mood you want. Okay. So my point is that cities are horrible places. Anyone who's got any drop of motive goodness, sattva gun in them, is thinking, you know, we got to get out of this place. This is hell. The throngs of people, the hustle, the bustle, it is not favorable for Krishna consciousness. This place here is majestic for Krishna consciousness. Everybody knows that. But what about how many people live in Brussels? 1 million. What about the million people in Brussels? And then how many in Antwerp? 600,000. Okay. Other big cities in Brussels? Belgium. Excuse me, Belgium. Yes. How many? 500,000. And then you have the, how many hours away is Amsterdam in the Netherlands? 4 hours. What's the population there? 1 million. So you have all these big metropolises around. How are you going to reach the people on a day-to-day basis so that they can become elevated enough to one day plug into this community without causing a disturbance? I mean, you've got a rarefied atmosphere here. You know, it's tranquil, it's transcendental, it's brahminical, all those good things. Now, first of all, how are you going to reach out to people where they're at in the cities to give them the seed of Krishna consciousness, and then how are you going to train them up, clean them up, so that they might be upstanding members of this community? If you just take them right off the street and put them here, there are going to be problems. They're not going to be able to handle it, and you're not going to be able to handle it. So what are we going to do? We have to establish centers in cities which are outreach centers meant for stimulating an interest in people and fanning the flame, building groups of persons who are curious about a Krishna conscious lifestyle and who are starting to apply it, just like Prabhupada did on Second Avenue, and then seeing where it goes from there. That'll be a subject matter we discuss on the last day. What to do with the people that you are cultivating, the people who you are planting the seed in. What do you do with them? To the ashram or not? What are the alternatives? We're going to discuss how you may have to provide some special alternatives rather than just make it, you know, a clean break. Either you're in the city or you're in an ashram. Either you're just out of it in the city, or you're a completely upstanding member of the Radhadesh community. We may have to provide some alternatives, because you'll be surprised, people themselves don't really know where they're at, and it takes some time for their heads to clear up and figure out what they want to do with their life. It's not like the 60s or 70s. I want to be a Paramahansa, yeah. Prabhupada took advantage of that. You know, Prabhupada, his unstated motto was, be all you can be. Yeah, be a sannyasi, be a pioneer in the frontier, be this, be that. But people are so much more degraded now. And we found we take big risks by plugging people immediately into at least a sattva-gun community, what to speak of Vishuddha sattva. It's very risky. The people can't handle it, except for a few. And devotees can't handle it. And so what's happened, as I said on the first day, is that unconsciously ISKCON in many cities of the world has actually given up on preaching in the city, other than going through the motions. Yeah, we got a program in the city. Yeah, we got a Sunday feast, and we give out flyers, and yeah, if the people come, they come. Yeah, you know, they can come sit down on the floor and hear a lecture, and you know. Do they want to be a new bhakta? They want to be a new bhakta? We got a room upstairs, brahmachari ashram. Yeah, throw some saffron on them. Yeah, stick them in the room up there. Yeah, what's the problem? Just like in the 60s and 70s. What's the problem? So anyway, my point I'm trying to make is, if we're going to be in cities, we have to be very serious about it. It's a great austerity, sacrifice to do urban preaching these days. And unconsciously, our devotees know that, and that's why they're not doing it. Really, that's why they're not doing it. It's tapasya. So what's going on in our hearts is that these people are out of it. I mean, what do I want to live in a city for? Or even if I live in this city, why do I want to reach out to these people? And, you know, gosh, you know. But we have to think of Prabhupada's example about how indeed he not only lived in New York City, but he rolled up his sleeves, so to speak. He reached out to others. He tried to understand their lives. That'll come out more when Mukunda Maharaj releases his memoirs. How Prabhupada was shoulder to shoulder with them in the trenches, so to speak. He was shoulder to shoulder with them when they were dealing with their everyday problems, whether it's addiction to cigarettes or marriage problems or whatever. Prabhupada was very much with them as a senior friend who was living life, and they were living life. Of course, he had, you know, a much superior perspective, but they never had the sense that Prabhupada wasn't, like, in tune with them. In fact, yes. In fact, they always, you know, Mukunda Maharaj is telling me, they always felt that not only was Prabhupada in tune with them, but how did he know more about them than they ever believed? I gave the example when Mukunda Maharaj got falsely arrested for possession of marijuana in his, you know, before he was initiated. It was a false arrest. And it was in the newspapers, and so Mukunda Maharaj said he kind of came to the center on 2nd Avenue the next day and kind of, you know, I wonder if Swamiji knows. And Prabhupada just gently called him over. You know, what's this? You know, what about this newspaper article? And then Mukunda Maharaj explained, I was framed, it was this, is that, and is that. And Prabhupada just said, yes, this world is like that. That's the kind of world it is. But Prabhupada was right there with him, with his problems. Not just, oh, I don't want to hear it. Yes.
Way of living and a certain number of wars and things that look like Krishna consciousness. friend of his friend. When he came in contact with him, he was in the person's house and he knew the refrigerator and he lived with the garden and he was taking acid and, you know, one day he looked his bed on the back step and gave him his knife and, you know, and ran out on the street and, like I said, he was going to the coffee house and said, hey, guys, it's time to class, you know, and, but I think many devotees are afraid that if they interact on that level, then it's going to affect it.
Yes, we're going to be dealing with this point, and not today, but we'll be dealing with this point. Being an urban missionary of Krishna consciousness is very demanding on your spiritual development. Therefore, there must be transformation. You can't work for transformation in others unless you yourself are constantly going through it. And the most pressing our immediate way to experience transformation is to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. Now, not everyone can be a full-time book distributor. And often people say that, well, we've distributed so many books. What are we going to do about the people who get all those books and who've gotten all those books? How are we going to cultivate them? So we'll also be discussing about this point in the coming days, too. Book distribution combined with cultivation. I see that as the new challenge, that a book distributor has to be a full-service missionary, not only able to distribute the book, but also to build up contacts and arrange that the people are serviced and arrange that the people are enthused, made enthusiastic to read Prabhupada's books. In this way, it'll be clear that we have to have spiritual strength. And Prabhupada said that Krishna consciousness should always be a great challenge. And through that challenge, you'll be inspired to follow the regular principles and remain pure. In other words, using today's lingo, because of the challenge, you'll be inspired to transform. So therefore, I always stress this mantra. What Prabhupada has given us involves distribution and transformation simultaneously. This is the genius of what Prabhupada has given us. All right. So we'll be discussing that point tomorrow or the next day. That's the fascinating part about being an urban missionary. You really have to learn how to depend on Krishna. And there are going to be things in you that are just going to come up and just say, I've had it. I'm tired of reaching out to these people. I can't take it anymore. What about me? Who can live in a hellish city? The stuff I've got to hear all day long. You know, all about their abominable Kali Yuga affairs. I can't take it anymore. Yes, those things happen. All right. So now, I want to get into some mechanics today. Besides dealing with conceptions, I want to get into some practical mechanics. An ideal situation for ISKCON to establish in a city is based on Prabhupada's idea of, remember when I said yesterday how Prabhupada in 76 said, I think we have enough temples. We don't need any more temples. We should establish restaurants combined with reading rooms. So a contemporary adaptation of that idea from Prabhupada is that we make our own cafes and lounges where people can come and for programs and yoga, Ayurveda, whatever fits in that's not objectionable to our philosophy, you know, Satvagun type things. And they can get some prasad, and there's a relaxed place where they can chat to each other. We shouldn't be afraid that people come to our places and talk to each other. That's a big draw. We shouldn't be afraid that people will come to our cafe or sit in our lounge and just start talking to each other about whatever they talk about. Just remember, they're doing it in your place. And they're being affected by the atmosphere, and gradually they're going to develop a relationship with the staff at the club. So what I'm proposing, what I do, is I train up groups of like urban Krishna conscious club hosts and hostesses who are just know how to be part of the scene, who know how to be hospitable and caring for people and gradually bring them along to Krishna consciousness, even without the people being aware of it sometimes. And also, these persons, eventually by their striking up, by their developing relationships, start selling lots of sets of Bhagavatams. Rather than just, you know, as the old lingo, which we don't like, hitting the people up for, you know, a little small book. They forego that. They don't worry about that. Wait a few weeks or even months until a deep relationship's formed. Then they say, how about this wonderful set of spiritual encyclopedias? And you'll find it's very easy to distribute full sets then, which is what Prabhupada wanted. And devotees told him it's impossible. So, in other words, you're creating your own Krishna conscious, cool, hip scene in which you can bring people along and develop them. Sankirtan devotees, book distributors, they love this because they can see that the people they're meeting on the street or wherever have a place to go and find out about Krishna consciousness in a very comfortable way. In my travels around the world, I hear from more and more Sankirtan devotees that, you know, it's just not enlivening us. We distribute the books, but where do these people go to find out more about the books? Where are they going to be treated nicely? Where are they going to get proper hospitality? In this way, after a while, Sankirtan devotees stop distributing because they you know, except for the rare ones who can just, well, we know it's causing the greatest good, we'll just keep on going anyway. If you're going to base your Sankirtan force on that kind of rare soul, like a Vijay, you're not going to have many people distributing books. Most devotees who preach want to see a personal connection. They want to see that the seed that I assisted Lord Chaitanya in planting is growing. If not me, someone else is helping that plant to grow. They want to see all these things and they become inspired. You know yourselves, you're inspired when someone you know or helped bring to Krishna consciousness starts to grow. You really get enlivened. So if we want our Sankirtan to expand and be wholesome and enthusiastic, the Sankirtan devotees have to have the confidence that this person I'm meeting on the street has a place to go to in the city where he can find out more about the book, he can be encouraged, he can have a very nice, loving atmosphere, she can go to a place where she'll be looked after. This gives such conviction to the Sankirtan devotees. And sometimes they themselves can drop by and see the fruits of their hard work. Look at that person. I met that person on the street a week ago, and here she is. Like, there's nothing more enlivening than that. So I'm recommending that we establish a kind of cool cafe scene with lounge where people can hang out and associate with themselves as well as devotees when they're ready to, and that the place is staffed by devotees who know how to deal with people, who know how to gradually bring people along, who aren't afraid to make some small talk, you know, who aren't afraid to listen to people for a while. In staffing the places that I'm involved with, I find the best persons, number one, are ex-Sankirtan devotees who are too sick or for some reason can't push on that service, but they're experts in establishing relationships with people, making people feel at ease. And the second best persons to do this are those who have become devotees through this culture. They know exactly how it works because it happened to them. So it's not difficult to find persons who can do this. The difficult thing is the place. And to find a place, because properties in cities are generally a bit expensive. And traditionally, we think of preaching that, you know, it's got to be money because I've got to pay for the place. So therefore, as I said the other day, if you're not afraid to charge people for everything, just like they come here on tours, they pay money, yes? Why can't they pay money when they come to your center? There are different ways you can go about this. A common way that I do it is that they pay a cover charge for everything. Prasad, yoga class, Leeladhar Gupta's Ayurveda presentation, whatever. It's all the same cover charge. Let's say, okay, just off the top of my head, maybe 10 euros, and you can do whatever you want in this place. You can eat all you want. You can sit around and talk all you want. You can go to the yoga classes. You can go to the Bhagavad Gita classes on the nights when there are Gita classes. You can go to the Ayurveda seminars, whatever. It's your place, your club to hang out in, to eat and talk and relax. And you're paying for it. In this way, also, it inspires the devotees to give a quality experience to people because the people are paying. By charging, it makes the devotees more responsible. And devotees are the best hosts. They're the most wonderful people. All right. So, the glue that holds the whole operation together is prasad. As Prabhupada said during the Second Avenue days, Krishna consciousness is a kitchen religion. So, the heart of the whole operation is the kitchen. Prasad has to be tasty, creative, variegated, not simply Indian food day after day after day, all types of vegetarian food. If you've got a lot of vegans in your area, you go with that. I don't recommend getting caught up in, you know, to be a vegan or not. Just if they want vegan food, give them vegan prasad. That's the glue. You see, everyone has to eat somewhere in the evening. This is something that we often forget. Because for us, lunch is a big meal. But for the non-devotees, dinner is the big meal. And most people under the age of 35 these days do not know how to cook satisfactorily. They don't have time to learn. They're working so hard. So according to their income, they go out to eat practically every night or they buy some processed food. No one has time to cook so much at home anymore. If they're married, both the husband and wife are working these days. And the last thing they want to do is come home from work and then cook a satisfactory dinner, which usually takes about an hour and a half at least to cook a decent dinner. I don't know if you had a mother who didn't have to work and she stayed at home and made dinner every night. It takes about an hour and a half, yeah, for a good meal. Not just, you know, boiled potatoes, but a good meal takes about an hour and a half. People don't have that kind of time. They don't have that kind of patience. So they generally go somewhere. That's why there's so much fast food businesses everywhere. McDonald's, whatever, Burger King, KFC. And those who have more money will go to a restaurant. I know in New York City, my brother's high-powered lawyer, his wife's high-powered lawyer, they don't cook at home. Every night they just go somewhere with a credit card and eat out. Thai restaurant, you know, Mexican restaurant, Chinese restaurant, Indian restaurant. This is normal. You'll find that young people also do the same thing, but they go to McDonald's or someplace like that. So what I do in trying to decide how much to charge for the cover price, what I do is I find out how much the average 20-year-old or 22-year-old will spend a night at McDonald's. How do you find this out? You have to talk to people. But that's, you know, it's amazing how many of our Hare Krishnas do not talk to people anymore. Perhaps it's as Mother Lakshmi was saying, they're just afraid to be contaminated. And there's no doubt the contamination these days is extraordinary. But also, we've become a bit insulated. So if you talk to people, you'll find out. The average young person, I know what they do. Okay, two Big Macs and a Coke. In New Zealand, that comes to 10 New Zealand dollars, which is about 5 U.S. I don't know what it is here. Does anyone know what the... 5 euros? Is that what the McDonald's goes for here? Yeah. So, What's that? How much? Yeah, that's what I thought. 8 euro minimum. So if you're a young guy, you know, you got to spend that. You got to eat somewhere. Don't think these people are not eating just because they don't cook. They go spend money somewhere. So he says, minimum 8 euros for two Big Macs and a Coke. You go to Burger King, and generally in most countries, Burger King has a policy of bottomless drinks. You can just drink all the Coca-Cola you want, something like that. So these young people, that's their scene. Monday night, McDonald's. Tuesday night, Burger King. Wednesday night, KFC. Yeah, that's because they don't cook. They're either working too hard or they're too stoned. They don't know how to cook. Really, this is what's going on. The girls don't know how to cook. You think the way it works these days is that a girl says to her boyfriend, yeah, can I cook for you every night? Are you kidding? It doesn't work like that. They just together, you know, reach in their pockets. Well, how much you got? Oh, I got 5 euros. Oh, I got 3 euros. Great, let's go to McDonald's together. That's the way it works. So always understand this point. They have to eat somewhere. Why don't they come to us? Why don't they come to us? Because maybe we don't have the right kind of scene where they'll feel comfortable. So therefore, what I do is I set the cover price to be the same thing they'll spend every night for dinner, knowing they have to eat somewhere. And, of course, the prasad we offer them is far better materially and spiritually than what they'll pay to get at McDonald's or Burger King or any restaurant. So, and not only does... not only are they getting prasad, but they're getting a yoga class. No one in any city except the Hare Krishnas is now offering a yoga class followed by a dinner. Now, this is such a big draw. You know, you work out in yoga class, then after the class you sit down and have a sumptuous dinner and talk to people, you know, like you who are cool, just like, you know, they all think they're cool. So you can sit down for dinner with other cool people. We're not afraid for that. Let them talk to each other. Let them meet boys and girls, whatever. They're paying for it. And gradually they're getting acclimated to Krishna consciousness. So in this way, you've taken advantage of their needs. They want exercise. They want yoga. Okay, we give them yoga. They want good food. We give them good food. They want a comfortable place to sit down and talk. We give them a comfortable place to sit down and talk. Gradually they start to realize... I think this is a Hare Krishna place. Even though you don't hide it that it's a Hare Krishna place, I've had so many people say, I know it's a Hare Krishna place, but I can't believe it. I mean, it's different. I've heard that so many times. I mean, is it really? I mean, they don't expect this. They don't expect that Hare Krishnas are interested in building relationships with them. They don't expect that at all. They don't expect to be given the free space to emotionally, not in terms of money, we don't give them free in terms of money, but free space emotionally to just be themselves for a while and stretch out and, you know, talk to other non-devotees without a devotee breaking up the conversation. Excuse me, I just want to tell you about Bhagavad Gita and how you're not the body. They're just not used to that. Or within the first 2 minutes having walked in the door, immediately someone, you know, puts some transcendental literature under their nose and, by the way, have you seen this yet? This is what they expect. So I've heard it from so many people. I can't believe this is a Hare Krishna place. Now, what exactly would be in the ideal urban missionary center? First of all, of course, you need a kitchen. The kitchen should be large enough for teamwork, because when you build a congregation, you want to teach them how to cook. They may not cook directly, but you want them to assist you, because, first of all, they're all interested in learning how to cook, because nobody knows how to cook these days. And they want to be vegetarians. They don't know how to cook. Secondly, you want that in the future, they're going to become part of the staff so that from the very beginning they know how to cook. That's another thing. Remind me to tell you about that. How to start people off from the very beginning with book distribution, cooking, and all these preaching kind of skills so that you can continuously have a supply of personnel for your project. Why wait until 2 or 3 years that they learn how to cook or distribute books or preach? Why not teach them from the very beginning according to their strength? So a good-sized kitchen is nice. Also, all the staff cooks. They share the cooking duties. It's a joy. And so the staff likes to associate in the kitchen in a Krishna-conscious way. Okay. Besides kitchen, you need a cafe area. Tables and chairs, silverware, plates, you know, not plastic plates and plastic spoons and forks and like that. You need a comfortable cafe arrangement where people can sit down and feel and relax, talk to others. Okay. Then you need another area, which is like a general room, general purpose room, which can either be for Sunday feast programs, kirtans, like that, or yoga classes, or big conferences, whatever. Then, ideally, you should have a seminar room, a smaller room in which anywhere from, let's say about 15 people can be seated on couches, comfortable chairs, and have an intimate discussion. Usually when Leeladhar Gupta comes, we have him hold forth in a seminar room, and people are nicely, comfortably seated on couches like a big living room, and then they freely relate. You'll be amazed at how non-Indians change their interaction patterns if they're just sitting on a couch and talking, like in their own living room. You know, they just kind of, you know, and they just naturally start to open up, much more so than if you put them on a marble floor and ask them to sit cross-legged. They're so uncomfortable, and so alien to them, they can't really reveal their minds. But just put a Westerner on a couch, and then they just start to hold forth, you know. Then they're at home. So the seminar room should inspire dialogue, opening up, relationship building, like that. And you want to create a comfortable living room atmosphere. So therefore, remember, you have the cafe area, tables and chairs. You have the seminar room with couches, holds about 15, 20 people. And then you can have a larger general purpose room, maybe a third the size of this room, where maybe 30 people can do yoga, and you can have your Sunday kirtans there like that. So in this way, that's all you need. I've done it with less space than that, but this is the ideal thing. Yes? Why? Huh? Why library? Well, I'll tell you, you brought me to a point which I recommend as a strategy, but obviously it doesn't say don't have a library, but I'm just touching on a deeper point. And you can process it as you like. It's best to have every activity there somehow or other leading to association with a devotee. So generally the way I run things is that sooner or later you're going to have to bump into a devotee. If it's just to have prasad served to you at the Bay Marie, you're going to run into a devotee who's going to be nice to you. If you want, in the places I run, we don't really have huge book displays and huge shops. We want, because I find as soon as you've got big shops and big book displays, the devotees do not build personal relationships. So they instead rely upon the presence of the shop. They rely upon the presence of the library. Yeah, just go in the library. All the books are there. There's the TV with the videos. Pop in whatever video you want, you know, Rathayatra, this, that, whatever. It's just sit down in front of the TV there. My personal policy is just my personal way. I don't want anything going on that gets the devotees off the hook from having to build personal relationships. So if someone wants a book, it's best that they hear about it from a devotee after the devotee has built up a personal relationship. Then it's very powerful. Remember, people are lonely. Now, you might say, well, sooner or later they're going to want to read the books. All right, sooner or later we want them to get a set of their own. We'll have a set visible somewhere, but it's not like so much a library. It's just to let them know that these books exist. But we want that the devotees build up a personal relationship which gets to the extent that a person will actually buy a set of books from that devotee. So we want to put all the pressure on the devotee. You've got to build relationships. You've got to deliver the goods. There's no escape. There's no videos. There's no library. There's no shop or don't take what I'm saying in a dogmatic, fanatic way. Just get the general principle, and then circumstances are different. The whole point is people have to become accustomed to dealing with devotees. And the devotees have to realize it's all on their shoulders. There's no escape. And that way, you really build strong persons in Krishna consciousness who know it's my life's mission to deliver the goods on behalf of Lord Chaitanya. I've got to become a purified instrument because it's all on me and my faulty self. It really inspires devotees to become purified, to transform. Who's going to help these people? It's not so much the video projector that's going to help them or the library. Sooner or later, it's going to come down to me and my faults. So I've got to purify myself. Okay. Now, I just want to make sure we get over the mechanics today. Location, where in the city? Well, if you've got a huge amount of bucks, you can be in the center of town, the ideal location. Generally, that doesn't exist, such resources. But if you're just somewhere off the center, that will suffice. Because you'll find that in these situations, these kind of preaching centers, you're not going to get a lot of walk-by traffic. The word of mouth is going to spread. People are going to come, not because they walked by your door, but because they heard about you. Therefore, if you're just in a convenient location in terms of transportation, that's all you really need. We're not the type of preaching establishment that we're going to get a huge percentage of walk-by traffic coming through the door. You know, someone walking down the street, oh, yeah, why don't I go in there? It just rarely works out that way. It's sometimes, but not often. The way it works is just like nightclubs, you know, cool cafes. The word of mouth spreads after a while. Yeah, this is a nice place to sit down, and food's great, programs are nice, cool people are there. They're hurries, but they're different. I hear that so often. They're hurries, but they're so different. So that's the kind of advertising you'll get. Also, of course, there can be flyers. The book distributors can pass out flyers. And sometimes we even do newspaper advertising, or newspapers come and do articles like that. But you don't have to have the bucks to be on the main drag, the main street in town. If you do, all glories if you got it. But if you don't, still you can do quite well, especially if you have a Sankirtan task force in the city which can distribute books combined with invitations to your urban outreach center. That's the best way to get the word out. People who buy books, I've seen in so many cities, people who buy books are the best customers for these places. They come already hungry for knowledge. I got this book. I want to find out more about it. Where do I go? So they can go to such a place. It enlivens them. It enlivens the Sankirtan devotees. Now, upstairs, above a store, is always a good location because generally the upstairs space is cheaper than the ground level. And we don't mind being upstairs because we don't deal with a lot of walk-by traffic. If you got the money to get a downstairs place, all glories. But otherwise, don't be afraid of getting a place upstairs, right on the fringe of the center city area, as long as public transportation is nearby and parking is not an impossible problem. Okay. Now, you want an environment that minimizes cultural barriers such as dress and devotee lingo. You'd be surprised how much people can really be intimidated by that. Now, what I told you the other day about resolving the direct and indirect preaching conflict, why not do both for fun and profit? So, on the indirect preaching nights, our policy generally, it's no hard and fast rule. On the indirect preaching nights, devotees wear chaste, regular clothes. People are coming for yoga class, for Ayurveda, for martial arts, for whatever. And, we want them to relax and see people they can identify with. And we don't get hung up about that because if they come on the next night, when we're flying the Hare Krishna flag, the direct preaching nights, they're going to find the same people wearing devotional clothes. So we kind of let water seek its own level. Some people just want to come on the indirect nights. Others just come on the direct nights. Some do both. So anyway, the devotees, the staff, dresses to play the part on a particular night. In this way, because there's so many people who have funny conceptions, we don't want to change just because of their funny conceptions. So at the same time, a few nights a week we can be, you know, we can bend a bit, a few nights a week. And you can do that knowing that this is not your, like a Sankirtan devotee, you know, sometimes goes out in regular clothes. It's not your complete life. So if we have the direct and the indirect preaching nights, the whole controversy is resolved. And by the way, I did point out to you Prabhupada's quotation from the 8th canto Bhagavatam that even sannyasis can wear regular clothes for the purpose of teaching Krishna conscious philosophy. So myself, actually, I don't do that often. In the beginning, I did. Now, I've started like giving lifestyle management seminars, and I'll wear a saffron turtleneck and saffron pants. Other times I'll just wear the way I am now. But everybody else on indirect preaching nights is dressed in chaste, clean, not rough-looking Western clothes. Now, what is the attraction for people to come to this center? You always have to be thinking, what do the customers want? Not what do the Haris want. What do the customers want? The customers want good food and companionship. They can't get enough of this. I remember that English word, which most of you didn't know what it meant, camaraderie. Do we have any expert translators here who could translate it into your camaraderie? Huh? What language is that? And everyone understands that? Everyone understands Dutch here? Or is any French persons? Yeah. Can you translate camaraderie into? Okay. All right. So this is what they want. Sumptuous food because they have to eat at night. They're not like Hare Krishnas who have their big meal at lunch. At night, they want to pack it in. And they want companionship, but they're not going to admit they're lonely. So if you offer these two things, then you're dealing with the marketplace, the demands of the consumers. Okay. Now, the last important point, and we're going to take off from this point tomorrow. Due to the change in Kali Yuga, in that it's much worse now than 20, 30 years ago, I have noticed, this is my perception, my own perception, you're not going to get many people seriously taking up Krishna consciousness if they just come to you one day a week, like on Sundays. It's too hellish now. Their minds are too wild. Their heads are filled with everything illicit. Reminds me of a statement in Chaitanya Mangal by Lochan Das Thakur describing Kali Yuga and its residents. So the people of Kali Yuga, he said, delight in wave after wave of lust, greed, and envy. You can imagine someone at the beach delighting in the waves, splashing in wave after wave. So Lochan Das Thakur says, this is what it means to live in Kali Yuga. You just love to feel those waves of lust, greed, and envy splashing over you. You actually delight in it. So this is what's going on now more than ever before. So people's heads are, you know, they're just full of the information age, you know, internet, television, movies, this, that, the other. It's much more intense than when Prabhupada was physically present on the planet. I've seen that if you just have a place for people to come to one day a week, you're going to have a tough time. You've got to get them to come through your doors at least twice and minimum three times a week. Then you know you can make some headway gradually. That way they start building devotees a taste for being at a Krishna conscious place. So if you think like that, what can I do what kind of scene can I create so that people will come at least 3 times a week? It's not as hard as it sounds. They've got to eat somewhere, remember. And they're lonely, though they'll never admit it. You give the best food at the best price and such a warm, friendly atmosphere. There's yoga, there's Ayurveda, there's Bhagavad Gita also for those who are fortunate. So you're creating a whole world for them in which they can feel uninhibited about dropping by more than one day a week. That's the secret of success. You get them coming by. You get a city person coming by 3 times a week. You're making big progress, and you're going to see some results. So we're going to talk about that more in the coming days. I just wanted you to get an idea of the mechanics of what is required. The kitchen, the cafe-like area with the tables and chairs, atmosphere, ambience. Just like your cafe here, I notice, you know, the glass windows, you know, it has ambience. If you can do something like that in the city, great. You don't have to spend that kind of money. The main thing is just a certain kind of mood. And then you need a seminar room, couches, where people can sit and discuss life. Oh, they love to do that these days. Yeah. What about my life? Can you tell me about my life? What should I do? What should my lifestyle be? And you need a general purpose room big enough for 30 people to do yoga and to have big kirtans on the Hare Krishna days like that. And you're away. One other thing is required is the staff, of course, the hosts. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. They look pretty trendy. They don't say love feast on them. Yeah, right. No. They say things like taste of another world or just something that doesn't look immediately Hare Krishna-ish, but at the same time doesn't compromise. Yes? That's right. We're going to be talking about that more in the coming days. This is what makes the austerity. If you're going to do preaching in the city, you're going to have to be prepared to stay up a little late at night. And that's tough for me because I like going to sleep at 8:30. But, you know, if I'm going to be doing my job, you know, I've got to sacrifice a bit, and it's tough. Music? We'll talk more about that in the coming day. I'm mindful of time, you see, and Hrida Chaitanya is back there ready to give me the, you know, ready to give me the hook. So, oh, he's not. Oh, yeah, he's looking, he's smiling, so, you know. I'll delay Kamakana Maharaj's seminar. So I've written this point down. Yes, I'll write it down. No smoking. Even at an ordinary karmi place, building up a taste for associating.